Whether you're fly fishing in a stream, getting those ankles wet, or deep in the ocean casting nets, fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Fish Nerds, the show about fish, fishing, and eating fish that's always entertaining, usually funny, and mostly true. Because Clay Groves is out with jury duty amongst all his other craziness. You've got Crappie Hippie sitting in the hosting chair tonight. I am Crappie Hippie, your tree-hugging redneck from eastern Kansas and co-founder of Glasswater Angling Lead-Free Fishing. And sitting over in the co-host chair tonight, I have got the incredible, the unsurpassed, the extraordinary Todd Correa, the fish rap writer.
Well, thank you. That's a heck of an intro. I feel like I should be wearing boxing shorts and dancing around a ring right now. Thank you. A little much, but thank you.
All right. I see now you've swept me away in a mental picture and I can hardly, you know, I can hardly focus.
That's not the picture you want in your head. That's not good. Just go back to Rocky Marciano or something.
with your head on his shoulders. Yeah, I know of a certain person that makes cards, trading cards to that effect. You have been busy trying to travel here and there. What's been going on, man?
Well, my son graduated from Full Sail University on Friday down in Florida. So we went down and watched him walk, get his diploma in music business, which was pretty exciting. And then we had the fine idea to fly home a day early, and pretty much the entire aviation world imploded upon our shoulders. And I got home about 12 hours later, and my son got back to Los Angeles about a day later. It was... I don't know if our decision-making was great or the airline gods are against us, but it was kind of a big, flat implosion. Oh, we're all safe and we're all home.
Well, that is good. But Allison, she escaped early, did she not?
My lovely wife, Allison, did manage to get a direct flight home. She was on track anyway. We just decided to
Yeah, you're spontaneous. Okay.
Right. So I guess spontaneous was better when I was young. It doesn't work out so well now that I'm old.
It's one of those crazy things. You just can't, you know, can't you just get us on the plane? You know, it's like, wait, just show up, expect to get on the plane. Oh, yeah, man, that's crazy, crazy. So I'm glad you're back. I'm glad that you came in this morning to help me do this. I really appreciate it so very much. Have you got any kind of fishing report for us? Anything going on? What's going on? I see Rosie's kind of gearing up, but she hasn't been out yet. Have you been out at all?
I haven't. The weather here in New England has been pretty much lousy for a long time. Weekends have been very cold and rainy. We've had biblical amounts of rain. I think it rained almost 2 inches just last night since I got home. Weekends have been terrible. There's been a lot of wind. We haven't had a whole lot of snow, but there's generally, with a couple of rare exceptions and 1 or 2 days of some ice in the northern part of Rhode Island, we just haven't had. It's just been lousy. So I haven't been out. It's over a month since I've been in the boat, but we're hoping maybe next weekend or the weekend after, next couple of days, it'll turn around a little. Spring is here, pretty much.
Yeah, well, it's leaping right out at us here in Kansas. We're having an epically warm spring. The gaffs are already up and blooming. I did not get a chance to go out and chase any walleye, which I had real FOMO, fear of missing out, for those of you who don't like acronyms, and really wanted to get out, but I just, business will not leave me alone, and I am going to have to put my foot down. But we would, you know, everybody says this all over the place. We would take some of your weather. We'd gladly trade some of our dry weather for you, some of our dry, warm weather for you, because that's not typical for this time of year here in Kansas. And March is usually a wet and muddy month, and it's just strange. We did get an inch of rain the other day, and that added to my pond, and I'm happy for that. But, and I've been able to get down to the pond a little bit. Crappie already running up to the bank every now and then. If you're lucky, you can come upon a little bush or a little pile, and it's really gratifying since I'm the one who put that bush or that pile in there, and catch several crappie off it. But, man, I have not been out to the lake, and I am starting to sweat the whole white bass thing already.
Well, you can have a little bit of ours. We're filled up here. Our ponds are full. The rivers are full. We have flood watches all about every 3 days, it seems like. But it'll change, you know, another couple months, it'll be dry and hot here. We'll all be complaining because it hasn't rained in 3 months. So, you know,
it's New England.
We love to say here, if you don't like the weather, just wait a minute.
So that's it. That's it. We're, you know, a lot of places can say that, and only because it's true. Well, what do you say we get on with some fish in the news?
I'm all for it. Let's find out what's going around the world.
Well, I'm telling you, I love fish in the news.
Everybody loves fish in the news.
News, news, fish in the news. Everybody loves their fish in the news.
All right, our first story tonight comes from Tim Tacklebox Beat. It's a great story. Comes from jolly old England. And they're talking about an organization called Tackling Minds. And this nonprofit organization in the UK offers fishing sessions to people with mental health problems. It's due to the research and tireless work of its founder, David Lyons. And 3 years since it began, Tracking Minds is now working directly with the UK health system, which has been persuaded to start prescribing fishing for patients with mental health challenges. So we talk about this from time to time on the Fish Nerds, don't we, Todd?
We do. And I have to say right from the onset, I think this is simply amazing. This is like a, it's an amazing, it's just the coolest opportunity to take these people who are probably very new to the fishing world, probably don't know anything about it, and teach them some of the amazing things that we already know, you know, like proper handling and the benefits of catch and release, all the things that we love, the passion of being on a stream. I guess they probably have their chalk streams, but being, you know, either with your friends or being alone on a chalk stream and catching or not catching. Those are the things that we already know. That, hate to go too far down the hippie world, but like the, you know, the inner fulfillment of being fishing and clearing your head and just kind of looking around and getting a stock of the natural world again, not just the crazy cities and politics that we all deal with. So, I mean, I'm totally impressed by this whole idea. I think these people are in for the, you know, a really wonderful opportunity to kind of change their perspective.
Well, they say it is a wonderful opportunity for so many reasons. It's not just getting out to the chalk streams and the canals and the different water bodies that they have there in the UK. But they say, you know, that 80% of the people that try this program out are new to fishing. And the large majority of them want to keep on fishing after they go through the program. They want to get their own gear and keep going. So it's a very, very positive thing. And there's a big tackle dealer in the UK called Angling Direct that is 110% behind this. They're donating money. They're donating bugs. They're donating rods and reels. They're donating equipment. But, you know, because, you know, everyone's in touch with this nowadays, the anxiety disorder, the dark thoughts, the suicidal ideation, the self-harm ideation. It's something that fishing has been proven to help with, and getting out and just getting away from everything that's on your mind. And what they say in this article is that fishing occupies just the right amount of your attention, and yet you can chit chat with the person you're fishing with. That part I really love when they're in here. Yeah, the quote here is, the idea is to create a safe space for people to open up about their issues. Angling is perfect for that. You are distracted by the fishing and there's no eye contact with the person you are talking to. And the conversations tend to be light and uncomplicated. There's no pressure, but there's still time and, you know, space and so on to carry on a conversation. So it's not just the act of fishing or catching. It's the way we do it and the amount of mental engagement that it inspires or that it attracts or that it needs. Anyway, I just think it's fantastic.
You know, I have to tell you, sir, that over the years, I've been involved in a few operations like taking veterans fishing. And one thing it gives them is an opportunity, obviously, to fish, to be taught how to fish. They don't really know. I've done some surf casting and some on boat adventures. If they don't know how to fish, they get some instruction. If they already know how to fish, they get some basic instruction on the new equipment, and then they're kind of allowed to go off and do whatever they want. But the point is, like, they can maybe talk about nothing or don't talk and just get some free head time. Or sometimes in the presence of another vet, they get to open up about something and kind of get it off their chest. So it's a win-win. Sometimes just walking a beach, we did it with with some vets in there against a beach a couple years ago, and they all got surf rods and reels, and they just walked the beach. And if they wanted to talk about something, they could. And if they didn't, they didn't have to. And I mean, that's really, this English group has really nailed it, because you provide people with that kind of an opportunity, A, to experience the joys of fishing, and B, to get outside And then C, to have that like comfort level. I mean, this is a win all around. Cheers to them.
Indeed. Cheers to them. And cheers also to Shimano, because they're helping out with this as well. So Tackling Minds, hats off to you. Hats off to Angling Direct and to Shimano for pitching in and supporting David with his project. And I am looking forward to the day that maybe somebody picks up the reins on this side of the pond.
Nice job, Shimano. Well done.
All right. So moving on, we've got some fly tying shops in trouble in Washington State. Proposed legislation that would affect and ban the sale of fur is a direct threat to the fly tires of Washington State and the people like the Pawn Fly Shop in Ilwaco that sell fly tying supplies. So what's going on here, Todd, is that it's a well-intentioned bill that wants to, you know, affect the fur trade, where we're getting illegally harvested furs or fur farming that is just nothing but a horror story. And we know how that can go. We've all seen the documentaries on the fur business. But it was done without any sensitivity at all to the fishers who depend on little small patches and, you know, capes and so forth from these animals, by and large salvaged from hunting, by and large raised on humane farms, by and large already regulated in terms of certain, especially hackle-bearing birds and endangered birds and birds that are being held in genetic preservation on farms. So just kind of a mess. I don't know. What did you think?
Well, I took two messages out of this. The first one is, I think they need to take all those alarm makers fishing.
Yes.
They need to put them in some waders, and they need to put them on a stream and show them the flies they use and why they use particular flies and why a certain fly does a certain thing in a certain environment at a certain time in a certain hatch, and have them understand why certain materials are used in certain ways. It also may drive home the point that while it may seem better to use artificials because that's an outsider's observation, in many situations, an artificial material is not going to work. It won't properly replicate what a natural fiber does. So A, take those guys fishing. Guys and girls, take them fishing, put them in the water, let them know. I also think that this might be a pretty good opportunity to kind of take a review of the fur industry. And, you know, this is not my world. I don't really know much about how these furs, on the wholesale level get distributed. But this might be a brilliant opportunity for some positive PR. Because if you're supplying, I mean, I have deer tail and deer fur in my freezer. It's from deer that, you know, I've shot. That's my natural way of getting what I need. But this might be an opportunity to show people where fur comes from, and not just the legislators, but the average consumer. This could be a really positive moment for that business and take some of that pressure off fly shops, which do not need any financial pressure right now.
No, they absolutely don't. And I will say this for the bill sponsor, Senator Derek Stanford, is that, you know, his head and his heart is in the right place. But yeah, that brother needs to go fishing, because he said, okay, he rewrote the bill. And then he says, you know, the fibers, as long as they're not attached to a skin. And of course, this gentleman, Josh Phillips, that owns the Pawn Fly Fishing Shop in Ilwaco, he's like, are you kidding me? You know, you don't go out with the razor and shave the deer hair off of that hide and fill it in a baggie, man. You need it on that hide to work with it. And you need your capes of feathers. I mean, we do some loose stuff, you know. I mean, I'm a crappie jig man, you know, all my boo, it comes loose and all that, and that's all good for me. But this other stuff, yeah, it's insane. I mean, you buy a cape, you want the little feathers at the top for this and the big feathers at the bottom for that, and the ones in between for whatever. And they can't not be attached to that skin, bro. So I think your point about taking somebody fishing is a good one.
I don't know why, but I keep having that old punk rock song, Take the Skinheads Bowling, is in the back of my head. Take the Skinheads Bowling. Yes. Right? It's time to take the lawmakers fishing.
Yes,
if they had gone fishing first, they would have answered some of these questions first and then drafted proper legislation that actually addressed the realities of the business and not illegalities or immoralities or anything else. It's just a good, solid business plan to have deer hair on a piece of deer hide or elk or whatever it is. So maybe we should have taken the skinheads bowling first.
Yeah, we should have taken them bowling first, because there are some things that I'm not over comfortable with. We were talking another time. I'm not sure about the Arctic animals, the polar bear fur, the Arctic fox, and so forth. I'm not sure I want Inuit people exploiting these animals for the fur and commodifying these animals. There are things, but you know, we're maybe there is a point, and a point could be made, and about, you know, restricting, regulating, or at least having a good hard look at it. But on the other hand, come on, white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, these are things that are harvested. These are things that can be raised. These are things that can be also done. The word escapes me, but
it's sustainable.
It's sustainable. And the semi, like in Europe, they have the wealthy people have the forests where the deer are almost tame, but they still just live a wild life out there. And we've got a lot of that going on in this country. We can harvest a lot of things humanely, sustainably, and so on. So it's really, when it comes to fly tying, it's really a very small body of people that just have to tie Atlantic salmon flies with forbidden materials, or just have to have polar bear fur on their jig because of the way it transmits light. I'm not going to get into that discussion right now. We don't have the time, but let's step back, take the skinheads fishing, take the politicians fishing, and let's do something for guys like Josh that are in a business that we love and that is disappearing. And if we can, you know, not hurt these fly shop people, let's not do it.
Amen.
All right.
Amen.
Okay, buddy.
That problem, John. See that? What? We just came across a problem and we just solved it.
We did just solve it. How come you and I aren't in politics?
You're welcome, everyone.
You're welcome, everyone. Next time you can't decide on something fishing, ask the fish nerds, gosh darn it. I don't care where you're at and what you're doing.
Well, that was easy.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so this last story is, it's funny as heck, but it's also shocking, kind of sad, kind of a downer, but it's also made hilarious because the nice lady that wrote it won, Caitlin O'Kane. Caitlin, I got some bad news for you, but it starts off on an Australian TV show featuring a chef frying a fish during a cooking segment last week. The fish turned out to be a near extinct species.
Oh, what would Homer Simpson say?
Yeah, the broadcaster and chef have since issued an apology after fishermen condemned the segment. ARF, a public radio and TV broadcaster in Austria, apologized for cooking the Frau Nörfling fish, which means female Nörfling, according to AFP. So let's just make this perfectly clear. Australia is down under, and Austria is in Europe. All right. Austria has the people in Lederhosen and the accordions and stuff. And Australians are people in khakis with big beards and beat up hats and fishing for Murray cod, like our own beloved Australian correspondent, Luke Chalmings. Am I correct there?
You are spot on, sir. Never the twain shall meet. Austria in Australia.
Never the twain shall meet, indeed. Yes. Anyway, it was a show for Lent. So here's a fish you should get for Lent, because the whole idea of eating fish at Lent is that you're making a sacrifice. Well,
I think the fish made the sacrifice here.
I think Mother Nature made it. Everybody's making a sacrifice. You know, you're wiping out a species here. And that's how I knew this wasn't Australian, because I get down here. According to local publication, Die Presse, during a broadcast this week on the show Niederösterreich Today, which, okay, I apologize for my butchered, mutilated German in advance. Anyway, last week they cooked on delicious culinary, the Frauennörfling, and the Latin name, I think, is even easier. It's Rutilus pigis. Then they found out that this guy that they had hired to go catch him a fish for the segment was only posing as a registered fish gatherer with good knowledge of what was going on. And there were only 500 Frauennörflings left. Now there's only 499 or whatever. But this fish is having a terrible time because of it. It's a deep water fish, but when it comes up to spawn, drawing the water up and down and so forth. And it's unlike most of carp minnows, it's in the minnow family. It's not very tough like German carp. So it really is struggling to hang on. It's almost extinct in Germany. It's barely hanging on in Austria and Switzerland. And cry and shame, but funny as heck.
Well, I, you know, if this happens again, I thought I might offer them some help from this side of the pond. I, you know, I might be able to do some graphic work for them. We could put up some signs out front in the restaurant. One day special. No, really, really. It's a 1 day special. No, really. This is a limited time offer. It's
very limited.
It's really limited time. How about this? Get them before they're gone. No, really. We mean that. Better get one before they're gone. I mean, what was this person thinking? I mean, come on, man. Wikipedia, for God's sakes. Look the damn thing up. Yeah. Figure it out for yourself, you know, before you go on TV. Good Lord.
Oh, it's just too much. It's just too much. Well, anyway, I'm glad that there was a lot of outcry, and I'm glad there are a lot of people that said, hey, wait a minute. You can't be frying up the Frauennerfling.
I hope they are genuinely remorseful, because that is tragic.
Well, it is tragic. It is tragic, but I'm sorry. Frauennerfling is fun to say. So I do not want this fish going extinct, because besides the fact that it's one of our species and our ecologic Jenga tower cannot have just random things pulled out of it without collapsing, be able to say Frauennerfling anymore.
Ecologic Jenga tower. Oof, I like that.
That's a Bill Nye. I'm stealing off Bill Nye. I'm not that clever. All right.
Another truth discovered on the Fish Nerds.
Yeah. Okay, my man, I got a communication from you, and you said, I got somebody for the show. Boy, did you ever. I'm going to let you intro this person. Our feature piece tonight is going to be introduced by Todd Carrere. We had a fun time laying it down. It's going to be a bit on the long side, so we've decided to split it into two parts so we can stop. You can run and get some more popcorn, some more beer, some more chips, some more whatever. Pop out, put some gas in your vehicle, and get going down the road again, whatever. But anyway, we're going to break it up, and then we'll go on with the second part. So Todd, intro our special guest, if you would, please.
I'd be happy to. This was a real honor for us, especially for me. His name is Bob Mallard, and I've dealt with Bob a few times over the years through various fishing connections. And Bob is the executive director of the Native Fish Coalition. He's based in Maine. And the concept is pretty clear. It's pretty simple. He's like a lot of other people, he's been involved in conservation for a long time in different areas, different forums, and he focused in on native fish because he saw a bit of a void as people are fighting for an individual fish or an individual species or one stream or something. And he kind of focused in on native fish in general. And over the years, he has really created he has some serious momentum to get people involved of all ages, of all demographic, of all backgrounds. And now he's pushing coast to coast to protect some native fish in their native habitat. And it goes with teaching not only the species and the, you know, the information about the fish itself, but it's the appreciation of the waters and the streams and the locations and their place in the ecosystem and their important part of the world. And, you know, one thing I've taken from Bob is that he really reminds us that we are just part of the chain. Maybe it's that big Jenga pile you're just talking about. We're just a piece of it. And sometimes humans think we're a little bigger piece than we probably are. And he's kind of reminding us that native fish are essential, regardless of the species, whether it's Maine or Georgia or Alabama or Kansas. Those native fish are absolutely essential to our ecosystem and to our very lives on this planet. So he's built this coalition all across the country. And the guy is really amazing. And he's great to talk to.
Well, he is absolutely great to talk to. And let's let Bob put it in his own words. This first part is on how he got the organization started and how things started coming together for him in a big way in a very short time. So sit back and listen to Bob Mallard, Executive Director of the Native Fish Coalition, talk about how he got started. Fish Nerd Nation, this is Crappie Hippie, your tree-hugging redneck from eastern Kansas, and we are in Glasswater Studios this evening with Bob Mallard, the Executive Director for the Native Fish Coalition. I'm really stoked to talk to this gentleman. We're going to learn about when they started, how they started, and we are going to learn about the different chapters, what their goals are, and what their initiatives are and how we can help them spread the word. Bob Mallard from the Native Fish Coalition, and here to help me out, running sidekick, is the fish rap writer, Todd Correa.
Whoop, whoop. Thank you, sir. Happy to be here. Bob, welcome. Welcome. Nice to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's really fantastic to meet you, Bob. I am completely intrigued by the Native Fish Coalition. Todd has the question set. I have a smaller question set, but I'm going to let my main man, Mr. Todd Correa, start this thing off. Fire when ready, Todd.
Yes, sir. All right. Thank you, sir. So, Bob, basically, I think what I'd like to do is, without you going too far back in time, what was your early motivation for promoting conservation of brook trout? You know, what brought you to this path, without going too far back in time, but what brought you to where you are now? And, you know, what are the motivations for your organization?
Well, there were these things called dinosaurs. Sorry.
I feel like you looked at me when you said that. That was kind of rude, Bob.
Maine, of course, we're the stronghold for brook trout and Arctic char and Atlantic salmon. And Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, which was the hook and bullet, a very influential lobby, they were carrying the load for native fish conservation in Maine for years under executive director named George Smith, that's been passed away. And when George was retired from STEM, it kind of slowed down, where all of a sudden we had this void. And so several of us, we were at a hearing pre-NFC trying to pass the bill that should have passed and didn't. Had to do with prohibiting certain non-native minnows as useful live bait because they'd be non-native to where we use them. And long story short, I was unaffiliated at the time. I had kind of dropped out of all of my groups just because I was tired. And I received a phone call in my car from a young gentleman from D.C. who was a Mainer working in D.C. And he said, I just listened to this legislative hearing. I'm embarrassed for my own state that bill didn't pass. He said, I know who you are. I know what you've done, but you need to get affiliated. He said, this lone wolf stuff doesn't work. So he offered actually to bankroll to get us started. What was most interesting, you know, mid-30s, high roller from work for a Republican National Convention out of D.C., and he said, if you're willing to get it back in the saddle, I'm willing to help start something. So all of a sudden, this idea that we would form a group that would pick up where Sam had left off and show up at legislative hearings. So this is where it kind of started. And so I immediately said, well, it obviously can't be just me. And I had been working with Emily Bastin, who was working for Audubon at the time on some brook trout related stuff. And I reached out to Emily and I said, hey, we got a chance to do our own thing here. And I think it's needed. So that's how it started. Emily, myself, the third person we brought in was Ted Williams, who's since left. And then, so we basically started and founded with seed money as Native Fish Coalition of Maine, with no intentions ever of getting beyond Maine. We were just going to pick up what had been dropped in Maine. So that's where we started less than 7 years ago. So it was a very small idea at the time. We were just going to protect brook trout, Arctic char, and Maine.
Well, let me cut in here if I may. So you dropped out of these groups and because you needed more time. And then a little while later, you turn around and start an entire organization. I love that. I love that. That's awesome, my friend.
I tell people I'm 65 years old and my warning is be careful what you ask for. I was trying to wind it down, not wind it up. And, kind of burnt myself out with advocacy for Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, started a Trout Unlimited chapter, started a group called the Dean Angling Society, which had similar goals to NSB, but but it wasn't a success. But we had some successes, but it was hard to keep together. So it's just kind of one of them weird things where you just feel like there's something that needs to be done. And of course, the world decides it's bigger than what you thought.
The what's the membership like now? How big is the organization now?
We now have 18 chapters strung from Maine to Arkansas, with only a couple of voids. So we're running as far west as Ohio. We got holes in Rhode Island and Delaware, but for the most part, we filled the southeast as far as Georgia, and then west in Alabama, and recently in Arkansas. Membership per se, it's not a focus, this classic membership, and that's for a couple reasons. One is, if we didn't want the pay to play model, I'm just going to say, like Trout Unlimited, where if you join for $35, you have a say, you have a chapter, and that wasn't something we wanted to do. For a couple reasons. One was, it's financially a losing proposition. You spend more money chasing members than you get from that number. And the other was that we didn't want to broaden the tent to a point where we struggled with the mission, we watered down the message. So we have what are vetted boards. So our boards, which are our voting presence in a given state, they're small, they're 10, 12 people. And this other membership, passive membership, it's a way of raising funds. It's a way of allowing people to support us where they can. We don't spend money chasing that membership. It's purely organic. It's profitable. It doesn't cost us any more money to process a membership than it does a donation. So this is how, the world that cares about Native Fish can support Native Fish Coalition. But our boards, we try not to get over 12 people, because the more people you put in the room, the more you argue about the mission. And we're not here to argue about our mission. We know what our mission is. And it might not be for everybody, but it's for us. And we feel there's no need to replicate what's already being done out there. So, our membership would be thousands at the passive membership level, not hundreds of thousands. But again, it's not a primary focus. It's a weird hybrid model where we said, do we want to go full-blown pay-to-play membership, or do we want to just be an absolute closed membership like a lot of other orgs out there? And we said, not really. We want to try something in between. And our next chapter, we're working on bringing up Wisconsin next. I've got a conference call soon with some folks out of Colorado who want to talk to us about a chapter. And originally our growth plan, first we had no growth plan, but then once we realized we had a need or a want for this, we kind of set this weird weird growth plan where it was me. I said, we'll grow contiguous. We'll go from Maine and New Hampshire, Mass, blah, blah, blah. Because I felt like that would be easy, doable. And then out of nowhere, I get a call from Dr. Matthew Lewis out of Alabama. He wants to form a chapter up there. So goes my idea of contiguous growth. And then I said, if they want to do it, like, why would we not do it? And the idea of getting out of or beyond trout and deep into the South was fascinating to me, because I had done a stint as a writer for Southern Trout, the sole Yankee to write for the publication. So we took that, I think it was probably our fourth, fifth chapter. And so we had this gigantic geographic hole between the South and the North, East, and then all of a sudden, over time, and it's been a very short time, we just keep filling it till we're now continuous again. And now it's kind of west and into the Southwest and into the Great Lakes.
So let me ask you this. If you've been involved in this many states now, as you sit in the shadow of a Trout of North America poster, what kind of species are you working to protect now? Since you have such a wide geographical reach now, what kind of species are you working with?
So, of course, we started as a brook trout sector, because we're Maine, and the brook trout's filled in New Hampshire. And, of course, if you're in Maine, by default, you also got to worry about Arctic char, last Arctic char in in contiguous United States and the last it went examined, but it was the Fulmonid-centric thing. As we pushed contiguously south, we continued that Fulmonid focus until Matt Lewis disrupted the apple cart and brought in these red-eye bass that us Yankees knew very little about.
Look how excited John King's getting right now. I see it says John's all excited right now.
It was awesome because as a writer for Southern Trout, they referred to him as Alabama Brook Trout or Bama Brook Trout. And so I'd never seen one, but I was familiar, and they'd send me pictures, and I'd see this, you know, beautiful, cold, clear water that looked like brook trout water, only with these small bass, beautiful. They got turquoise cheeks and red eyes and red fins and on. So all of a sudden, we have this focus on red-eye bass. And they, you know, they're suffering some of the same issues as brook trout. They're being bumped out. But we were still game fish. So as we started, like, the next thing we knew, we're looking at these rare stream resident bass. Then we're kind of bumping into alewives in Massachusetts. And before you knew it, you know, we're heading into the Great Lakes in Ohio. Our Ohio chapter is, like, totally different than everything else we do. Their primary focus is on minnows. Darter and shiners and stuff, and these kids, and I love it, and I am, like, I'm dying to get out and hang out with these kids. They're crawling around on their bellies with masks and snorkels and collecting these little tiny darters and showing children on the sides of the stream what they got.
Fantastic.
And of course, yeah, and then we bump into gar and bowfish and all kinds of crazy stuff. And I honestly, being a Maine guy, we have, from a fish standpoint, we probably have the lowest diversity of any state. We don't have a lot of species in Maine. And so as we move into these southern chapters, you know, we're going into these really, really biodiversity-rich states. And I just honestly, I knew there was an interest in brook trout. Because as a Mainer, we might not always agree with what we all got to do to keep these fish around. But we do agree that they need to be kept around. And Maynard, no matter what, spin, bait, fly, eat fish, don't eat fish, when a Maynard says trout by itself, he means brook trout. You know, if they want to talk about browns and rainbows, they say brown trout and rainbow. So in Maine, we don't have that argument about whether browns, you know, belong or rainbows. It's all about. And we thought that was a unique Maine thing, only to find out that these red-eye guys are as, and women, they're as into their red-eye as we are to our brook trout. And then we start bumping into the non-game fish and the, you know, and then some of the, you know, these off fish, like the bowfish gar, things that, you know, I knew about, but not a lot. So all of a sudden, we found out that there was this demand, this odd demand of people who care about native species.
Right on.
Right on indeed. Pardon me, Todd, but I got to jump in. You're answering my questions in advance, Bob. There, I was, because I'm big into, we have this thing in Kansas right now, the younger anglers, the more aware anglers, like myself, who can't be numbered among the younger anglers, about the native species like the buffalo suckers, the gar and so forth, that are not recognized as game fish here. So like if you're a bow hunter, you can go out in April and kill 100 gar and there's no protection for the gar, there's no consequence, there's no, I mean, it's just allowed. It's just one of the weirdest things ever. And groundswell, it's slow. This is Kansas, but we're getting to where people are just like, gar are a slow growing fish and so on, we can't just let this kind of thing go on. And you're right. The Mississippi drainage has a lot of species, and there's some philosophy that we need a lot more. But I'm all in. I can see how this kind of just went completely crazy, mushroomed on you like that. That's awesome. I think it's so awesome. I'm really thrilled.
I personally, I'm loving it. You know, I honestly didn't think I'd live longer.
Okay, that was awesome. I know it kind of cut off, listeners. That's just because I'm not a professional editor, and I go into listener mode sometimes. And I'm just sitting there listening along, and all of a sudden I'm getting the warning, and then all of a sudden the poor man has been cut off. So he's a heck of a guy, I'm telling you, Todd.
He's really motivating. The guy's an inspirational guy, and he's also, you know, he comes off, because he is, he's like a blue-collar guy like the rest of us. He's not high and mighty. He's not preaching something that you should bow down and understand his ways. He's just telling you what it is. He's telling you the facts. He's a supporter of Trout Unlimited, of which you all know I'm a big supporter and member of. He will be speaking to Rhode Island here where I live. He'll be at the Rhode Island chapter banquet in the first Saturday of April, and he's going to be the keynote speaker, because, which is really wild, because, you know, Trout Unlimited is focused on cold water fish and fisheries, and we're bringing in someone with a slightly different perspective. It's of more fish besides trout and the environment and the cold water. So it's a little different perspective, but it's a perfect mesh for us, I think.
It's going to be fantastic. All right. So if you're in the Rhode Island area and join Trout Unlimited, you can get on over there and watch Bob. That sounds exciting. But right now we're going to move into part two, where Bob talks more specifically about their projects, about his philosophy, about what motivates him. And here we go with part two of Bob Mallard from the Native Fish Coalition. We left off where the whole project is mushrooming. There's young people in Ohio snorkeling for darters and shiners and such. There's a doctor in Alabama out to protect the Suwannee and the Coosa and these kind of southern bass. Fabulous, fabulous, fabulous. And so the Native Fish Coalition is starting to move west, south and west. And we were talking about, you're looking at getting into the western states, the big five out there. Actually, I don't even know if is it five? What is it? Colorado, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico.
Idaho.
Yeah, Idaho. Don't forget Idaho. Yeah. I can see this going everywhere.
Whether I'll live long enough to see it, I'm not sure. However, I do think it has legs. I do think it's going to spread. I do think that there will be NFC chapters all across the country. The big surprise was we've taken the moral high ground for a long time. Trout fly guys, I'm a trout fly. When you could argue that nobody's drifted further off course, nobody's promoting non-natives to the degree that the trout fly fishing industry is. Nobody's more dependent on docking and husbandry than us. Nobody's more accepting of non-natives. So what we're finding is that there's this giant, like, underground pro-native movement of people way outside of the traditional, you know, trout fly fishing community that care about gar and bowfish and sturgeon and stuff like that. The other thing that's most interesting is that we've been bleeding membership for decades now. I've heard my whole life, you know, we got to get youth, we got to get, you know, got to get young. And so here, all of a sudden, by pure accident, you know, I'm not going to take credit. We found this thing that interests young people. And the very people we've struggled to reach for decades through the standard model we've had in place. I speak at TU chapters on gun clubs, and I'm 65 years old, and I'm one of the youngest people in the room. And that's pretty scary. Yeah, when I go to an NFC outing, I show up at a show, whatever, I'm a by far the oldest guy standing around. I'm surrounded by 30-somethings. We've got kids 15 years old. If I had to guess, our average age is in its 30s, not 70s or 60s. And so what's kind of interesting is, you know, we've accidentally stumbled on this way to engage the very people we've said we wanted to engage for decades, and yet there's still some resistance from within our own ranks. There was a really a distasteful article written recently in Green about the native fish movement going too far. Like, are you kidding me? Too far? We haven't gone nearly far.
Hang on. You ain't seen the plan book, baby, because, you know, we're just getting started now.
Yeah, it's just like, what are we afraid of? You know, does anybody for a moment with a rational thought believe that non-native fish are going? They're not going. They're never going to. They're here to stay. However, if we can save what's here if we can regain some ground, why wouldn't we want to? That's the part that befuddles me. You know, the whole goal with NFC at this point, having far exceeded any of my wildest expectations, is to give to these young people a platform, a media, something they can run with, something that I didn't really have. I knew what I wanted to do, but I never really was given the platform to do it. And so at this point, because I put my foot out there and decided that this was a good thing, I'll ride it out till I can't ride anymore. And my sole goal is to leave younger people with an organization that they can run themselves, that they can focus on what's right. There is no conservation in non-native, you know, naturalized non-native trout. There's none, zero. They are there at the expense, you know, of wild native fish. They're not a placeholder, you know, they're ecologically a negative. And the same thing's going to happen with bass if we're not careful. Red eye are going to disappear as, you know, shoal bass, pushed out Alabama bass, on and on. And who are we to leave the planet in worse shape than we received it? My grampy didn't fish for non-native fish. And why should we? Why should we pass that on? That should not be our legacy. Sportsmen are supposed to be, and we should be, the stewards of the resource. Fish would get out of the damn water and show people, you know, how beautiful they were. They get somewhere, but they can't. So it's up to us. The average person has no clue. They don't see them. They don't understand. They don't understand the big impact. So it's fascinating to see. And again, it just happened. People would get past this idea that this is some threat to the status quo. Understand, it's organic as hell.
Organic. That's the word I was waiting for you to say, Bob.
You know, I was answering an email tonight from a gentleman talking about this particular wild native brook trout fishery that he saw me holding a picture of a big fish. And he mentioned that docking was the way to bring kids back off the computers and into the woods. And I called him on it. I said, you know what?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I totally disagree with that.
And I said, you know what? I don't agree. I went down as a little boy with either spinner rod or fly rod I barely know how to use. And I caught sunfish, perch, and pickerel, and I was ecstatic. I didn't know that they were bad fish until somebody told me. Until somebody told me I should be fishing for stocked trout. And it wasn't until years later that I realized that was not really what I wanted to do. I was perfectly content fishing for sunfish, perch, pickerel, and
right on.
So yeah, it's like why are we putting so much money into these artificial, you know, man-made fisheries? It's sucking the life out of us economically. It's not a good message to send kids that fish are born in a friggin' fish tank. We're just gonna put them out there. You know, would white-tailed deer hunter except what we've forced down the throats of our young trout fishermen.
There's a financial loop. There's a feedback loop there with stock trout. We all know that story. The more trout you put in the river, the more licenses you sell, the more $3 to $1 match you get back in that license, the more hatcheries you can build, the more fish you can put in, yada, yada, yada. So we all know that. I mean, it makes sense for the young kids or the parents taking their kids fishing. There's from a 10,000 foot view, it makes sense. The kids go down and catch a fish, but from the reality and the natural world, it doesn't make any sense at all. The hatchery system is an economic fail. It just supports itself through license sales, and that's why states mostly won't give it up.
Economically, the model isn't working. We're looking in Vermont now. Second time in 3 years, they're faced with a major budget shortfall where a hatchery is on the chopping block, and it's $600,000 a year. And, you know, there's no general fund money, and anglers don't want to pay for the licenses, you know, on and on. So what's happening with the whole hatchery model is the cost to raise fish is going up for a couple of reasons. Transportation costs, infrastructure costs, food costs. And, of course, we got to raise bigger fish every year because anglers aren't happy. And we're creating this absurd belief that, you know, just stumble in your river anytime you want, grab five fish and go home. But where that model breaks down the misidea that if we stop stocking, we would like lose all these anglers and lose all this money. I do not believe for a moment that an angler stops buying their license because we stop stocking. I don't believe it. And the other thing is when we are more worried about a sportsman who needs to be subsidized by the rest of us, we've lost our way. This is no longer about financial absolutes. It's about a model that's got away from it. When you look at the cost per fish for stock trout these days, I'm just going to throw out a number, $8.50, $10 a fish, whatever. And a resident license costs $25. And all of a sudden, three fish into it, and you're short money. And we're getting that money from hunters and warm water fishermen and catch and release fishermen. So at some point, all sportsmen need to speak up and say, if you want to raise these fish, if you want to harvest these fish, you pay for them. I'm tired of paying.
Bob, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the problem with that theory is that one is difficult and one is easy. I can walk down and, you know, I can throw up my power bait and open up a beer in a public pond and catch a trout in pretty short order. That's easy. Educating fishermen and fisherwomen and fisherpersons, whatever, to, you know, the beauty of stalking a river and not catching anything, maybe, or maybe catching a fish that's only about the size of your palm. That's the difficult job. It's the most important job because that's the way things used to be. And that's what supported the fisheries for years, was that acceptance of the natural world. But that's the heavy lift. And when you have opening day, and you know, for 2 weeks before opening day, they're putting 3, 4, 5,000, a couple hundred fish per pond, and you know how big they are, and you know what time they went in. That's easy, and that's very difficult to overcome.
Yeah, but we did it. You know, this wouldn't have happened if we didn't do it, if we didn't set this unrealistic expectation. When we put 12-inch fish in a 6-foot-wide stream, you know, Mother Nature is never going to give you that fish. But I'll always go back to my wonderful, wonderful childhood, you know, fishing. You know, right through high school, of course, I had distractions, fast cars, girls, everything else. And however, I never stopped fishing. I was called in high school the fishing fool. And as a really little kid, I came home with a bucket of sunfish to show my Grammy and then go back to the lake and dump them in again. I mean, I was not unhappy about that until somebody told me I should. And that was our own doing. This is State Fish and Game model. It's the Trout Unlimited model. It's the Rod and Gun Club model. We've created this monster, and we can't feed this monster, or we can't corral this monster. And at some point, this problem will solve itself because we cannot keep up with the stocking cost, not with declining participation and increasing cost. It's just, it at some point hits a wall.
Well, at some point someone's going to have to realize that the solution over time is to take a portion of that money, be it half or three quarters of what's invested in the hatchery and the maintenance of a hatchery and all the ancillary costs, and put that into protecting the rivers and the streams that harbor native fish. Put that back, take a portion of that and make it into education for the fishermen. Teach them why it's more important and why it's more significant to go catch a native fish. Take all those monies and put that towards conservation and not just put and take. And you might, you know, maybe they'll put a little piece at the bottom and put a statistic about the amount of stocked trout that go into a pond and are dead a month later because they don't know how to feed themselves in a wild environment, or the birds pick them off, or the fishermen take them. Take that money and put it back into a natural stream is money far better spent. So if you, as you've expanded south and west, do you feel like, and with the caveat that Maine fishermen, Maine anglers are far more in tune with their native brookies, but do you feel like the state of Maine is on board with your group? You know, do they, whether it's because of you or with you, do you think they're in tune with protecting the native species?
The reason Maine has a more pro-native stance than most states, because we've got more natives. When you live in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and I and you are faced with this concept that maybe we should be thinking more of brook trout, and you don't have any brook trout, or the only brook trout you have are 6 inches, that's a tough pill to swallow when, you know, we're giving you 18-inch rainbows. When you live in Maine and you're surrounded by what everybody else has lost, it's an easy sell. Why do I need rainbows in Maine when I can go get 16-inch brook trout and dry flies in the backcountry? So
well said.
That's the difference with Maine. And so the challenge is these other states that have lost so much. And, you know, so the idea, and now as far as has Maine bought into it, and I assume you mean Fish and Game and stuff, we go up and down. The last commissioner was great to work with. Fish and Game Commissioner, the current, is not great. We have this program, wonderful, 585 legally designated, no stocking, no live fishes bait. You'd struggle to find that list on our state Fish and Game website, but you'll find a friggin' link that says where, quote, where we stocked yesterday. Why, in a state like Maine, do I need to tell people where I stocked yesterday? Do you believe people are driving from Massachusetts, where they stocked 16-inch fish, to come to Maine to find 14 and 10-inch fish, stock fish? No way. So our guys have lost their way as well. This problem with this hatchery stuff, it's nationwide. It's not Maine, it's not Mass, it's not anybody. It's everybody. If you're in a trout state, so what's happened is the fish and game departments have convinced themselves over decades that they can do a better job than Mother Nature and that we can control this mess. And the beauty is that they can't control it. They're losing control. We can't keep feeding the monster anymore. But they,
I think John's head is about to explode. Look at him.
Yeah, look at him.
He's
gonna go
crazy.
His hair
is on fire.
Well,
right now.
I don't want to interrupt Bob because he's on a beautiful, beautiful roll. And I just keep, you know, the whole thing. It's like we have the McDonald's model. We have this corporate model where everybody's got to eat the same crap, and we'll all just be a lot easier, and we all catch the same fish. I mean, how ridiculous is it to read the post on the Fish and Game site? We'll be stocking trout here on this date. And then the trout, these fishers are standing right there when the trout are getting dumped in. They get dumped in the pool below the what's it dam. And there's 50 anglers standing there. And so they go from the hatchery into the river and then right onto the hook. And then right, you know, you might as well go to the freaking store, right? Because you're not selling the real experience. It's not the real experience. And this is where I love these young people that are craving the real experience. We have a the Fish Nerds Guide Service is Clay Groves and this guy, Vinny Maturo. And Vinny, part of his job with the guide service is to take these folks up into the White Mountains, and they get these young people from Boston coming up all the time. They don't care about size. They don't care. They care about good Instagram pictures. They go up there, catch 34-inch trout, they're over the freaking moon about it because they're sure. The markings, the surroundings, the experience, the hike, the health, the beauty, total package. Every trip is the same but different. All right. This stamped out mass-produced type fishing. Kids right now, you know, and younger people, you know, try to avoid the confrontation, putting people down and confronting people. It has very limited value. The whole idea though is like, look, I know what the reality behind this stock fish is. I might as well just go and get one at the store. It's getting to where the micro fishing and the fish nerdism, the geeking out on all the things in the stream, in the woods. This is the experience that I'm hopefully we're shifting to. And this is why I was so excited to talk to you, Bob. And the more I find out and hear you speak, we're looking at getting to where love what you got, baby. It's beautiful. Kansas ain't got no trout, but we got paddlefish. We got long-nosed gar. We got some cool stuff here. Go have a ball, okay? And rant concluded, but anyway, I hear you. I understand you. I'm frustrated by a lot of the same things that frustrate you, my friend, and you too, Todd. And I think that this is a wonderful thing, and I hope it keeps going and spreading because I would love to see it international. Canada, Mexico. One thing about Maine, I learned Rhett Talbot is a Mainer that used to have a podcast. One of the ones that really moved me is the one about the char ponds, and how we have these different strains of char and then one of the ponds got contaminated. Some Dipso put Lakers or something. I can't even remember what exactly happened, but it's like, these are irreplaceable fisheries. You want a one of a kind experience. We can have a fish park experience.
So,
or we don't have the real thing.
Let's take Arctic char for a minute. We've got the last Arctic char in the contiguous United States. We barely promote them. How on earth can you have something no one else has and not make money on and not get interest? I've been working over the years now, because I've written more about Arctic char than probably anybody alive, with young people who contact me and say, Bob, I want to go catch one. They don't want to eat one. They don't want to mount one. They want to catch one. And they want to release one. But an interesting thing was last year, some young boys headed way, way up in northern Maine. And they somehow found cell signal, report back to me, send me an email, how things are going. So these kids thought they were going to go out. They were camping and they were going to do 4 or 5 days. And I said, look, you pound this water and you focus on trying to get char, and you do this all day long, you will probably catch a char or two over the course of 4 or 5 days. And so long story short, I get a report back, kind of disappointing, no char, but as like a side thing. We caught a couple of 16-inch brook on dry flies. But they were upset because they still hadn't got their char. Finally, like 2 days into it, I get an email. They've got an 8-10-inch char. They are on top of the world. And I had to tell them, do you know that you've emailed me like 2 or 3 times with the biggest brook trout you've ever caught in your life, and you're not that happy? And now you've got this 10-inch char, and you are fulfilled.
Right on.
And this is the same thing. I am dying to get to Alabama and chase red eye. I bought a rod just for it. I got a chest pack ready to go. I got a net on order. I'm heading south as a Yankee trout guy, and I'm going to go wallow in the red eye water, and I'm going to love every friggin' second.
Some hush puppies and learn the local culture.
We've done a wonderful job of making trout fishing a bit of a culture war. We have found an Edison. And we're all avid fly guys. Shit, I owned a fly shop for 15 years. I'm a registered fishing guy. I'm a fly designer. I got 5 books, fly fishing books, 100 articles. But it's not my lifestyle. I don't see it as anything more than something I love to do. But what we're finding is the support for the native fish is not necessarily fly fishing centric. We have a huge program in Maine. We're posting signs on the 585 state heritage fish waters. And to be honest, we've had far more support for going to the backcountry, posting these signs on their own time and dime from the non-typical fly angler than we have the classic fly angler. And that's quite an interesting thing. When my average volunteer on this project has a Red Sox hat, not a stage hat, that's telling us something. You know,
I love that you're paying attention to all these like ancillary statistics that when put together make a lot of sense. I love that you're watching all these factors, you know, not just age and skin color or something, but you're watching all the little nuances to see what your organization is all about.
I just met a guy downtown, my own hometown, Skowhegan, Maine. He had been snowmobiling and said that our char signs were pulled down at a boat launch. The only signs we ever lose, boat launches. And the moats up never vandalized. We don't get bullet holes. Every sign in Maine has bullet holes in it, but not my friggin' char sign and my state heritage fish sign. And I don't mean mine, our orbs. But the interesting thing there is that when we first started, people were like, this thing's going to get blasted off the trees. I said, I don't believe that. I think there's a certain pride in having these waters that the average person who's in that pond, he's proud of that pond, he or she. And we have not seen this vandalism, but we do get it at boat launches. But, you know, this gentleman emailed me and said, by the way, your signs up on Bald Mountain Pond or Penobscot Pond, he said, they're gone from the boat launch. And he said, I'm heading back up, snowmobiling. If you meet me in town with some signs, I'll post them. Now I go to Tom. He's got some stickers on his truck. I know the gentleman, you know, he'll eat some brook trout. He's not, probably doesn't own a pair of waders. He does most of his fishing out of a canoe. He lives in rural, deep rural. He might be a lumber grader or something. And so that's what I've told people. So this is not your classic fly fishing trout organization. It's way different. It's way more diverse. And in that, you know, I hate the term inclusive, but this is like organically inclusive. Awesome. I mean, you know, we're seeing 15-year-old kids on boards in our chapters. You know, we're seeing, you know, I've got moms emailing me saying, you know, I know my son's really too young for this, but could you guys mentor him? And she tells me all about the fun. I said, mentor him? I'll put him on a damn board. Right. You know, he's 15 years old and he's interested in this stuff. We'll put him to work, man. We got a home for him.
So I know you're headed to Rhode Island in a few weeks for the Trout Unlimited banquet. Have you decided what you're gonna talk to the people about? What are you gonna talk to the members about?
Yeah. So RITU, they're a great ally. They're a different chapter than most. And they kind of reinvented themselves. And now, you know, they're leading the charge in Rhode Island. I don't care what anybody says. These guys have nudged the needle more than any. So they asked if I'd come down and present, and I'm gonna. And we're gonna, you know, when I present to a fishing group, it can't be all conservation. So I'm gonna present on Maine fishing, but I'm also gonna present on Maine native fishing. I don't care about our smallmouth or brown trout fisheries on the Kennebec. I'm going to focus on our wild native brook trout. I'm going to talk about salters. I'm going to talk about our char.
Good.
I'm going to talk about, you know, the fact that we have the only viable Atlantic salmon left in the country. And I'm going to mix in some of what NFC does to try to, you know, nudge all this along. It'll be kind of a hybrid presentation, a little different than I would do for a typical fly fishing show. If I go to a fly fishing show, I can't preach too much. I got to kind of talk about fishing and slide in, you know, some conservation.
Right on. Excellent. I'm sure they'll be very glad to have you speak. Excellent.
Couple of things. First of all, we had the good fortune. We've got Mr. Correa here, and we had Mr. Glenn Place on the show, and got to learn a lot about what he's into and what he's up to, and he tells a great story. Give me a practical hands-on project that you've done. We have a listener, guy that runs the North Country Angler Fly Shop in New Hampshire, Steve Andrews. And he is like just insane about when people stock non-natives onto natives or pick something else. It doesn't really matter, but give me something. Give me an example of how you've stopped something or enhanced something or improved something or restored something. Give me a story.
The primary thing that NFC did, we looked at where we were at. We looked at where the focus was at. We looked at what wasn't happening. And we decided right out of the gate that if this was going to work, we needed to go back to ground zero, the very beginning. And that beginning is, what is native? Why does it matter? What are the threats? And what can we do about it? And that was very different than what other groups were doing. And we said, we're taking a lot for granted. How do we go back? How do we explain that brook trout belong, that brown trout don't belong, that the reason they don't belong is they do that? So that was our big thing, was information and education. And there's not a lot of glory in information and education. You know, you're not handling tens of thousands of dollars. You're not pulling out dams. But what was interesting is it was recognized. People from other orgs who weren't threatened by what we were doing, they were like, dude, you make out easy. You're doing something that we probably should have done a long time ago, which was to tell people why we're doing it. We got really involved in signage. We were putting up signs we did Down East Maine. We were up there looking at Sea Run Brooklyn. And we all kind of regrouped in a parking lot. And I said, you know, I haven't been up here in a long time, but you know what I noticed? And everybody's, you know, kind of waiting for my answer. And I said, I just was on the Machias, the East Machias, the Denny's, you know, the famous, you know, down East Salmon Rivers. I never once saw a sign that said I was on a native Atlantic salmon. I said, how on earth can we be where we're at, where we're spending millions of dollars to try to restore a fish, and yet we're not telling anybody why or what? So we worked with Down East Salmon Federation, and we created some signs, and we put them up. And Down East Maine is way different than the rest of the Maine. You know, they got these things posted. We didn't go through the hoops that we would normally go through for permissions. And I was, like, nervous as hell. Like, I think we should ask these people before we put the sign on the tree. And they were like, Bob, this is Down East Maine. First call I get is from a town manager, and I'm thinking, oh boy, here we go. We put a sign we shouldn't, and he introduces himself. Oh, I noticed your sign down on blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, you know, I'm sorry if we did it where we should not. I'll get somebody right up there. He goes, no, no, no. He goes, I got a spot, you know, a mile up the road that could use a sign. And I was like, wow.
There you go.
We did some informational signs on Sea Run Brook Trout that just said they were there. And I got some emails from non-anglers who said, I thought that little brook trout would go to the ocean and come back. That was the big thing that we did, was pound. We did it with hats. We sold thousands of hats. And I don't care, and decals and everything. I could care less that they say Native Fish Coalition. What I care about is that they say Native Fish. When I pull into a parking lot and there is a truck with a that says Native Fish on it, when I bump into a kid in a show or a stream and his hat says Native Fish, I know we're making a difference. So that's
well done, Bob. Well done.
All right.
Made a difference,
Bob. I hate to cut you off because you're a brilliant speaker, and I got a minute 42 right here, real quick. I mean, you set me on fire, baby. I'm ready to, you know, if I wasn't so tied down doing my own green trip with Glasswater Angling, lead free fishing, I'd be off and running on this, brother. So when a kid listens to this, or an old hippie like us listens to this, wants to get involved, how do they start a chapter? What direction you've got? Less than a minute and a half. Tell me how to start a chapter.
info@nativefishcoalition.org. It goes to me personally. I answer every single inquiry. If you want to know more about what we do, nativefishcoalition.org. We have an expansive website. It shows all the chapters, what they're doing, our mission. We have FAQs. We are totally transparent. Everything we do, full disclosure. So, you know, that's the game right now. And if people want to start a chapter in a state, I need 8 people. Give me 8. You know, 6 to 8 like-minded people, and we'll make a chapter work.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. Quick question from the state of Rhode Island. Can you put seafood in chili and still call it chili? The clock is ticking. If there's
no,
fish
sir.
In chili, is it still chili? The answer is no. Okay.
No, sir. It's like Maine. Well, they say in Maine, if you're kittens, born in the oven, does that make them biscuits?
All right, so I thought that was fabulous. He made so many good points, and you know, you have these things that float around in your brain, and sometimes you listen to somebody and they help you synthesize that all together. And his whole point about, hey, when we rely on this very artificial method of stocking fish constantly, stocking fish here, stocking fish there, you know, we're teaching the wrong thing. We're teaching, because fishing is an experience. Now, is the experience supposed to be just instant video game type gratification? Or is it supposed to be an appreciation that grows over time and grows with observation and grows bit by bit? And I think the three of us come down on the side that the artificial, corporate, stamped out, cookie cutter, you know, just go show up on stocking day, get your fish, go home, is not for us. And we don't think that our money should be used to back that model.
I agree. There is some value, you know, taking your kids fishing for a day, going down where you know there's some trout in the pond. There is some value to that. But I think as we get smarter as a people, as we get wiser and have more perspective about the natural world, the put and take fishery kind of doesn't make sense anymore. It's very expensive. It, in many cases, damages the native populations, which is obviously what he's focused on. And it takes away, as you said, it takes away from that sort of purity of going fishing and catching or not, just experiencing the natural world. And I don't want to sound too out there, but there are ponds where you can go and throw in a piece of power bait and, you know, smoke a cigarette, and 18 seconds later, you got a trout. So it's not terribly exciting. It's not what he's after. I also have to say, I love something you said about the stickers and the swag that they sell. He said, you know, I don't really care about it. That's not why, I love seeing a Native Fish Coalition sticker on a truck. I love that, but that's not why we're here. We're not here to sell junk, or I shouldn't say junk, but swag. We're here to, teach people about fish and fishing. So he's a really inspirational guy. And you're absolutely right. You could just sit back for an hour and just listen to him and forget to ask any questions.
Well, it really is amazing. And I'm with you there. Of course, kids, new anglers, so forth, they need to find angling success. But I think we can, do that with bluegill. I think we can do that with small trout. I think we can do that a lot of different ways, because once again, it gets back to, this is fishing, not catching. This is what fishing actually is. It's nice to take the kid out and have him be successful right off. And there's ways you can do that, mostly by trading size. But anyway, wonderful, wonderful guest. And we sure appreciate you bringing him to us, Todd. But I tell you what, I'm looking at that old clock on the wall and we're about out of time, brother.
Tick tock, man. Not the video, but the time. Tick tock.
So listen, man, I think some people have sat around and listened to three old hippie fish nerds talk when they could have been out fishing. We'd like to thank Wally Pleasant for our theme music, Diana's Bath Salts for our Fish in the News music. We'd like to thank Tim Beat for submitting stories. Huge thanks to Bob Mallard for coming on the show. Huge thanks for Todd Correa, the fish wrap writer, for dragging in here on a Sunday morning after his intense and long travels and booking Mr. Mallard for us. Thank you so much, Todd.
Love that Tim Beat, man. Love that guy.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't? I'm almost finished with my sculpture. And I would like to thank the listeners most of all for bringing your ears right on in here and letting us fill them up with fish stuff. Please keep coming back. Give us a lovely review if you would like to. Please hit that like, smash that follow, support us any way you can. But most of all, thank you very much for listening in. You make our lives very special with your participation. And until next time, follow the code of the fish nerd, spawn early and often.
And never, never take a free lunch with strings attached.
And swim against the current every chance you get. Todd, we made a podcast.
Hey, how about that? What happens if it's a free lunch with shrimp attached? Do you take that?
Is that probably a hook in it? That's what.
Thank you, man. I love being here. This is a real treat, man. I love being here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, John.
Whether you're fly fishing in a stream, getting those ankles wet, or deep in the ocean casting nets, fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.
Just for the halibut.
Fry it in a basket or broiled in a pan. Eat it raw like you're in Siam. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.